This is Sierra Dahl with the Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum, and we're going to be talking today about the different codes and zoning ordinances that are most successful with builders and developers. And we have today on the panel Kevin Moyer from Pace Equity, Larry Mayer, who's with Larry, what do you want to go by your Comfort Homes? Is that what you want to use?
Yeah, Comfort Choice Homes. Yep.
Comfort Choice Homes. Shalon Planks from Microgrid Architect and Tim Bancroft from Quest Inc., all of whom are going to be talking a little bit about some of the things related to that topic. So, Kevin, do you want to just kind of start us out with a couple minutes here, talking a little bit about what you think would be some of the better approaches towards zoning and builders, developers, zoning codes and such? Kevin, are you there? Kevin Moyer, are you there? Well, okay. I thought he was here. Larry, why don't you go ahead and start? Okay, I'm not hearing anything.
Larry, I had to call back in here, Sarah. I got dropped off.
Oh, really? Okay. Not good. Huh.
You might check to see if everybody else got dropped off, but I don't know.
Is everybody else here?
Mr. Shalom, I'm still on.
Yeah.
Did you, anybody else get dropped off here, or just Larry? Okay. Well, Larry, why don't you go ahead? Kevin, are you here still? No? Okay, Larry, go ahead.
Yes, Larry Mayer, Fargo, Comfort Choice Homes. Regarding the question of codes, zoning, and policies for developers and builders, I find that builders typically don't want to be too bold in doing energy efficiency strategies, not wanting to be too far ahead of the market for energy efficiency. So the codes that I found are the most effective to them are codes that require them to do blower door tests and getting their houses rated. And in that way, they start to learn building science by getting tested, and they can train their workers or framers on better practices once they have some testing mechanism that works well. The other aspect that we found that works well is going back to 2x4 construction instead of 2x6 and putting exterior insulation on the outside of the structures. And that way they don't have a humongous 10-12-inch thick wall. They can have about a 6-inch wall, and yet they can get better performance out of these buildings. The other aspect that we've had some success with is doing a thickened slab on grade structure to do a 1 or 2 story structure, which reduces the cost of a full footing. And we can then insulate and waterproof that structure much easier to give us some better results. That's on the builder side of it. We're realizing that unless we can work in concert with the realtors and the appraisers and lenders, we don't have much of a market to work with. And so we've been putting on building science training for realtors and builders and lenders and appraisers, and we actually bring them all in the room together and do joint training with them, which is sort of unique, but we find they all get excited when they see the other professions getting trained also, so they don't feel like, on the builder's point of view, that they're the sacrificial lamb that always has to make the changes and not sure if the house will sell. So those are some of the key things. Two other short comments is that RESO, R-E-S-O, which is the Standards Organization for the Multiple Listing Service, has published a new standard, which will be required of all multiple listing services January 1, 2018. That includes a bunch of green categories for getting houses to be rated, which is very important for the realtors, the appraisers, and the lenders. And this is a new element that we're incorporating into some of our cross-training this fall. Those are the sort of the key points that I wanted to share today.
Okay. Shalom, do you want to make some comments? Shalom.
Sure. Sure. This is Shalom Flank. I'm a microgrid architect, and I kind of come at this from a very different perspective from Larry, so I think that's part of the benefit of these kinds of calls. I'm more focused on the kind of district scale solutions that require a bunch of different end users or builders or building owners to all be participating in the same measures in order for those measures to work well. So, for example, district heating or cooling. You got to put the pipes in the ground. You want to be able to serve every building that the pipes pass by in order for that investment to be worthwhile. If you have a single owner like a university campus, then it's easy. But if you have a lot of different players, then what are the levers, and especially the municipal policy regulation levers, that can get the participation percentage up high enough that those kinds of measures make sense? Connected to that is also something we're working on called non-wires alternatives, where traditional utility investments in transmission and distribution infrastructure can be deferred if you can get enough distributed resources in the particular location that's facing the bottleneck on the grid. Again, you've got multiple actors. What are the levers so that you can get enough magnitude of response from your distributed resources and also be able to have sufficient confidence that those resources are going to be there, that you can defer those wire investments. And that's particularly important because those decisions need to be made sometimes years in advance, since if you can't rely on distributed resources, you need enough lead time to build the new transmission line, build the new substation, et cetera. So very eager to hear everybody else's experience or ideas for what the right mechanisms are to get the response from builders, building owners, et cetera.
Tim, do you want to say something about that? Bancroft Quest Inc.
Sure. I can't really speak to zoning or how to support the grid, really, but my perspective is more coming from a energy efficiency program implementation point of view, kind of echoing what Larry said about greater collaboration, fostering the successful, you know, implementation of these codes that are necessary to meet our goals. We build our energy efficiency programs really on the backs of the contractors who are doing the construction work and actually installing the light bulbs, building new buildings, what have you. So something that we did when the last round of California Title 24 energy standards came into play in 2014 is that there was a pretty huge impact to our energy efficiency portfolio. Most of those savings still come from lighting projects, at least in the kind of small to medium sized customer. And one of the things that we did to kind of tackle that was start working more closely between our contractor community and our permit counters at various jurisdictions to figure out how we could streamline the permit application and other documentation in order to get those projects accepted and installed and verified. The other thing that we did was actually conduct some hour-long interviews with some of our most productive contractors to figure out how we can fine-tune our program models to better align with their business model. And so we also ended up conducting more training on how to certify projects that trigger Title 24. And there's also been some discussion about how to recover savings from those projects that the contractors might be kind of staying away from because they aren't sure how to tackle Title 24 in a cost-effective way. So we've also looked into incenting them on a, you know, cent per kilowatt hour basis to tackle those more difficult projects and give them more support throughout the development process.
Okay. Did either Kevin or Michael Walton make your way over here? No, guess not. So why don't you...
I just did.
So Kevin, is this you, Moyer?
Evan Hughes made it in.
Oh, okay, good, Evan. I'm glad to hear that. So, okay, so if anybody has any questions for each other, go ahead and let's discuss this topic a little bit. And anybody else who has any particular experience in this area, please chime in.
Well, this is Larry Mayer. I come from the commercial industrial world with Honeywell. And why I say that because I have worked with large complexes with demand control and district-wide heating systems. I've always been a little jaundiced about how you would do that with a bunch of independent actors being individual homeowners or condo associations that would get formed if you're doing multi-tenant complexes and how to do metering and control of that. That is a concern that I have on how you can manage that. In other words, can the energy savings be enough to overcome the additional overhead and administration to make it work? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, this is Shalom, and did I hear correctly that Baird Brown is on the call?
Yes, he is.
Well, Baird, I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about the covenants, codes, and restrictions about the parks at Walter Reed as an example of how you can get the coordinated action. Not that it was easy, but there at least was a method that seems to be working so far.
Sure. Shalom's referring to a project that he and I were both involved in that was a redevelopment of 66 acres of what used to be the Walter Reed Army Medical Center in the heart of Northwest DC. It's going to be a mixed-use development with everything from research labs to, shopping to residential real estate. And the with the encouragement of the District of Columbia government, who was, giving out the property under the BRAC program, the developer pursued a microgrid and ended up hiring Washington Gas under a concession agreement to build a microgrid, including district heating and cooling, for the entire development. What Shalom is referring to is that for a variety of reasons, partly to do with electric regulation in D.C., we structured all this so that the homeowners association that was formed by the developers and was going to be, include all the building owners in the entire development became both the owners, just like you might own any common property in a condo or other development, of the entire distribution system, and also had the rights to enforce the concession agreement after the developers stood down and, went their way when the developing was all done. So the community would have a way of controlling the process once the developers stepped out. So that was very effective. And for a new development on what was essentially a a greenfield site, although it had a bunch of existing buildings that were being reused. How you make that work in existing urban fabric is a whole other question, it seems to me, although I'm aware of folks who are doing that on the electric side, not on the district heating and cooling side.
Bear, do you have a knowledge of what they did in Toronto? I know they put in a huge geofield out on, I don't know, Lake Ontario or whatever, and brought it into their district heating and cooling environment. Is there anything in what they did a number of years ago that would apply to what we're talking about?
I'm not familiar with that, I confess.
Okay.
I mean, it sounds like a great idea. I mean, I think, you know, Cornell has taken advantage of the Cuyahoga to, you know, do the same thing for the whole campus.
Right. In the Cornell case, they're the single off-taker, and they they own and made the capital investment based on their own loads. The Toronto, the lake cooling district, I think is a very interesting case, and I don't actually know how they were sure that they would have enough off-takers in order to justify that upfront capital investment. I think there are some very instructive differences between what Baird was describing for the Walter Reed site in contrast to another site that was also in Washington, D.C., where P. N. Hoffman was redeveloping the waterfront area. And they had also looked at district heating and cooling, CHP, in a microgrid approach. And economically and technically, everything looked good, and they wanted to proceed. But they didn't have the kind of land disposition agreement that was true at Walter Reed. So they weren't in control of all of the property at any point in the development process, even though they were the lead developer. So they couldn't put certain requirements into the Homeowners Association or into the codes, covenants, and restrictions. They had no way of kind of securing that cooperation across the multiple developers. And so there wound up being no common energy infrastructure, despite the efficiencies and the economic savings that they foresaw. There was no mechanism for doing it.
Yeah, this is Baird again. There are mechanisms in existing law in a lot of states for things like business improvement districts or other similar, you know, by different names, where you can impose a district to create common infrastructure, and it would, if there was a case where it was interesting to do, that would be worth looking at.
So I'd like to interject here. We have, I think, Michael appeared. Michael, is that you?
Uh-huh.
Yes, I was able to round him up, despite our passcode faux pas here. Michael, why don't you go ahead and talk for a couple minutes about what you're doing. Michael is with Green Spaces Chattanooga and involved in an enormous amount of different kinds of interesting projects. But we're talking about building codes and zoning ordinances for cities and such that would encourage developers and builders. So,
yeah. And so I guess I've got a couple relevant perspectives on this. I'm an architect by trade. And before coming down to Chattanooga to run Green Spaces, which I'll talk about in just a second, I worked on the green construction codes in Washington, D.C. And then before that, I was working in Knoxville with the mayor's sustainability initiative there. Green Spaces is a nonprofit in Chattanooga. Our mission is advancing the sustainability of living, working, and building. And so we do that with a series of programs. We do education and outreach in low-income neighborhoods around affordability of utilities. We have a green business certification. And then we also do demonstration development of net zero energy projects. And so that's sort of my perspective on this.
Michael, this is Shalom. For any of those, like the Net Zero projects or the other things you've been working on with Green Spaces, are there any examples where it's beyond the single building, where you're working outside the building envelope in order to get the efficiencies?
I'm not exactly sure what you mean.
So the examples I always go to are district heating or cooling or
I haven't done any district scale renewables or systems yet. That is something that we might look at in the not so distant future. We're working on potentially doing a 2-megawatt solar installation on the demand side of a large industrial user. Is everybody on the call familiar with, in terms of the specific topic at hand, are you guys familiar with Soul Smart?
I'm not.
No.
So I think that's probably, one of the best things that's out there right now in the renewable energy side of the policy space. It's part of DOE's Sunshot Initiative, and they've done a really great job of sort of building a toolkit that cities and local jurisdictions can use to streamline the solar permitting process. And they have a really great range of examples that cities and other jurisdictions can use, that is everything from just making it straightforward so that it's reliable and expectable to also offering incentives and, specific benefits to people that want to do solar and sort of building that into their portfolio. But I highly recommend that people check that out. It's really been a great tool that we've used to help bring down some of the barriers here locally. Like as an example, for the zero energy homes that we're building, our permit for the solar for one of these homes, and we're talking about a 4.65 kW array, which is nothing. It's like 15 panels. Our first permit got denied because the code, the land development office, saw this line in the form-based code that was being used that said rooftop equipment in this area has to be set back from the roof 10 feet or screened. So it's obviously talking about, like, rooftop chillers for commercial buildings, but because the language was loose, they're like, well, solar's are some sort of rooftop equipment, and this house doesn't have it set back 10 feet or screened, so denied. just absurd. Yeah.
Although that's from the perspective of you have someone who wants to do solar and you're trying to reduce the barriers. In a lot of places, fortunately, we're getting to the next stage where a lot of the barriers are gone. And the incentives are strong, but the uptake is still really slow. Certainly in Washington, that's the situation. To use the example I was given before, if you're trying to say, don't build that new substation because we're going to put in enough solar, you know, even with all the incentives, there may be forms of ordinances, codes, other kind of stronger forms of motivation to get that uptake percentage to really move up.
I think DC's sustainable energy utility is a pretty good example of that. It was started by an act in DC, I want to say back in like 2012. But it has built a really, really robust SREC market that does both energy efficiency and renewable energy for homes and businesses. And they've had a really, really strong uptake in, I mean, a relatively short amount of time.
It's definitely steps in the right direction. I have to say the SRECs in D.C. are terrific. I just got my check yesterday. It's over 40 cents a kilowatt hour for the SRECs. Systems pay back in like 3 or 4 years, and there's just absolutely no excuse not to do it.
Yeah.
But then you wind up, we're working at, this is another land disposition example, a former mental hospital in Washington that's being converted to mixed use. And one of the things that's being built there is a practice arena for the Washington Wizards, the basketball team.
Yeah.
And this is public land, and it's being built by DC Events, which is a public authority, and they're designing the roof in such a way that you can't put solar up there. It's probably 100 kW worth of space. But because there's nothing that says you have to do it, or at least have to make it what we sometimes call solar ready, they're just focused on other things, and it's not included in the plans.
Hmm. What are they doing that makes it impossible to put solar on?
They're chopping up the roof into these, you know, my apologies to whoever it was who said that they were an architect by trade. Was that you, Michael?
Yeah, that's me.
Right. They're making the roof look nice by chopping it up into all these things at different angles that all shade each other and just possible to put the panels up there. So it's about aesthetics, not about functionality.
I have one question here, just to break in. I have a phone number here that I'm not accounting for. It's a 917. Evan, is that you?
I called in on Skype. I have
a 917-453-5740. Can anybody tell me who that is? Must be Evan. Okay. All right. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
This is Larry Mayer. When you talk about zoning, it would seem to me that if you zoned or laid out a development so that your streets ran north to south, so that if you had a gable or a shed roof design which faced the front of the house, your side lot would be your solar panels, would have a benefit without people objecting to the look of solar. Are those types of things being done in other markets?
I don't know.
I think from a zoning perspective, I mean, most of what I've seen I would go back and say SolSmart probably has some good examples of sort of positive zoning language that jurisdictions can copy, but most of it has to do more with solar access, just to basically ensure that you're not going to block your neighbor's ability to put solar on.
Okay.
And I guess maybe going back to the last question about, you know, the roof design for that particular project, you know, this is probably the bias of the architect in me, right? Like, I don't personally know that, like, every single building has to have its roof covered in solar. I mean, I think there's plenty of opportunity to do either community solar at, like, the neighborhood scale or to do, you know, regional solar at much larger scales in the, like, hundreds of megawatts. Because in many ways that tends to be more cost efficient. Now, if you want every single building to be net zero, then I mean, obviously every square foot of roof needs to be covered with solar. But I guess at least in my mind, I don't know that that's the necessity.
Yeah, the benefit of having that much solar on the local scale is the impact on the larger grid. So with the kind of regional hundreds of megawatts, that relies on the transmission infrastructure and then down to the substations and so forth. But the local solar can reduce the amount of power that has to be drawn from that larger grid, and therefore in certain locations at certain times, I might help to avoid some investments in that grid that would otherwise be pretty expensive.
Yeah, this is Baird. Shalom is absolutely right. It's also true that the regulatory issues in siting community solar compared to putting it on your own rooftop get more and more complicated. If it becomes just another utility power plant, that's one thing, but it's not, you no longer have the incentives and the activity of a community solving its own problem. So there are different issues involved.
Yeah. I will say, like, in an environment as dense as DC, the technology doesn't exist. For each of those rooftops to actually generate enough for the building, the efficiency just is doesn't exist. The bullet center at what, six stories or seven stories in Seattle has their rooftop system is larger than the footprint of the building, and is able to generate enough for that building, and that's, you know, half the size of the average building in downtown D.C., where they have a height limit. Yeah, and it's pretty heroic. So my point is that, like, the rooftop is, at least in the foreseeable future, in the next, like, two decades, it'll help if the entire roof was covered with solar, but it's never going to get, you know, to island ability for that neighborhood in a community as dense as DC.
Agreed.
So, you know, you're going to have to pair that with other renewable assets. So that's why I guess, I mean, I'm not so tied to the idea that, like, you know, there should be particular policies that require every roof to either be able to have solar or have solar.
You're hearing the crickets. I mean, I don't think anybody, I don't know if anybody thinks there should be a requirement that everybody have solar. I'd like to go back to Larry. I was very interested in what you were saying about bringing in the appraisers and the
realtors
for training and
there's a big opportunity there. Yeah.
One of the questions is can we bring in the banks too and get them to start asking people when they want any kind of a mortgage or new loan, you know, have you done your energy efficiency yet?
Yeah.
Right. That's exactly right. How many of you are familiar with Sandra Adamias?
Sandra
Adamias. She's out of Florida. She's consulting with 40 other states on training builders and realtors and appraisers on how to properly appraise a green home. And I partnered with her in North Dakota and Minneapolis, St. Paul market to put on cross training where we bring into the same room at the same time a realtor, a builder, an appraiser, contractors, and some building inspectors. And people say to me, you'll never get everybody in the same room. And I said, well, you know, I've been able to accomplish it, but it's taken tons of phone calls, a lot of times personal visits to get them to even show up to a meeting. But once we get them all in the meeting, it's amazing how excited everybody gets, because they don't feel like, as the typical builder, the sacrificial lamb that's going to somehow move the green building industry forward. They see the other actors in the room together, and they start asking questions and dialogue, and they can't wait for the next training session. I've asked my home builders group to be the lead, even though I personally call all the players. We're going to put on a community-wide town hall where we're bringing the heads of the Realtors Association, the Builders Association, the lenders, and the appraisers into a room together to set up a 2 to 3 year training curriculum where everybody's on the same page. Because as I've seen the industry over the last 6-7 years on the residential side, and again, I come from the commercial industrial world where I controlled the whole world because Honeywell did the financing and leasing, and I could engineer and just, you know, steamroll ahead with my project. But I've seen that none of these players talk to each other or work together. And I just can't see how the industry can move forward without them getting on the same page as much as you can. And it takes a lot of legwork, a lot of phone calls, and a lot of one-on-ones to get them to show up to that first meeting. But once you get into that first meeting, they all get excited. They see that this looks like it's real. It's not stories they see in the newspaper or on TV. It's real. They see the other actors and getting training together and start to move forward. So we did a 1 year of that, and now we're starting year two. The state of North Dakota gave me another round of funding, and we're pretty excited to be able to see what we might accomplish here. And we have a very difficult energy market. I mean, we have 9-cent electricity, the cheapest natural gas in the world because of the Bakken. So we're not saving a lot of energy money. We're talking quality buildings, comfort, health. Those are the drivers in our market, not just sheer dollars.
Have you guys written up what you're doing in any coherent place?
We haven't published anything. She and I are collaborating right now, just literally this week and next week. The actual final format of the classes that we'll be putting on in November, so that we can get our continuing ed approval in each of these professional areas for the builders and the realtors and the appraisers. We have to send in our curriculum to North Dakota and Minnesota Commerce Department to get approval for the classes. So we're just in the process of putting that together. But we're basically going one step beyond what we see the rest of the country doing right now, where they're just talking codes and talking mostly to the builders. We're trying to take the next step. And as I see the industry, you know, in order to have mass appeal to green, you really have to start moving these residential builders into the commercial world, where you have, you know, more set plans, more design work, more verification on how that plan, before you even start to build it, is going to perform. And you know what the anticipated energy ratings are going to be. In my market, the average builders are just clueless about that. They've never seen it before. All the more to get them confidence when they see the realtor and the appraiser and the lender in the room with them in getting them to training. But it takes a tremendous amount of footwork to get those meetings going. Sandy tells me that most utilities will just send emails out to all the builders and expect them to show up. And she'll fly in there, and there'll be 15 utility people in the room and about 4 to 5 builders. And she says, she says that story is over and over and over again across the country. And I said, yeah, I can believe that. So those are things that we're seeing working here, and I don't see any reason why. People are people. They don't want to be sacrificial lambs trying to carry the weight of the industry. But if they see the other professional groups in their market at the table getting training together, then they all actually see it's real, and they start to get excited about it.
Yeah, what you just said is exactly.
I'll be brief. Fine Home Building Magazine had a sort of an article-length editorial on it, exactly all of this. I'm going to say 3 months ago. I think it's really exciting.
Yeah, we're doing the exact same thing in Chattanooga. And, I mean, that was the point of the demonstration development that we're doing, is to use to educate the realtors, the lenders, the builders, as well as the general public. And ultimately, that, in my opinion, is the key to successful energy efficiency codes and zoning. I mean, that's why DC was able to pass the green construction codes back in 2014, is because the market was already there. The market was demanding that level of construction, and so it wasn't that much of a push to get the developers and builders and architects to agree to raise the code standards.
Right. Right, you're exactly right. And to give you an example, the classes I've been putting on in the Twin Cities, I have to guarantee to the trainers that there will be no loss and that there will be a positive cash flow. And I'm a design engineer in Fargo, North Dakota, and I have to guarantee that to put on classes in the Twin Cities because none of the builders, realtors, or appraisers want to pony up any money to put on these classes, and yet the state is pushing the utilities to spend millions of dollars in incentives to do green homes, but the state does not want to get involved in putting training on. And it blows my mind. The last time the big power companies in our market in the Twin Cities is Xcel Energy, and they had 3 times as many utility people sitting in the room as they had builders. And I'm sitting there, I said, you know, I have 4 times as many builders show up to my training, and my market's 1/10 the population that they have there. And yet commerce people show up to those meetings in Minnesota, and I ask, well, see, you need to do training. No, we don't. We'll just throw dollars on the ground and expect it to happen, and it just boggles my mind. But anyway, that's, I think, might be typical of a lot of big metro areas. Everybody's in it for themselves, and there's really no community spirit. And without somebody being the lead to do cross-training, it just doesn't happen.
So I have a question for everybody. It's almost at the hour right now. Do you want to continue this conversation, or do you, everybody have meetings at on the hour? Anybody?
I've got a couple more minutes.
Yeah, I have a couple more.
Okay. So we'll just keep on going for a while longer, and until people, if they have to leave for another meeting, that's fine. Go ahead. One comment here. I think Larry's doing some extremely important work, which is why I was really happy to have him on, and North Dakota of all places. So I really give you a lot of credit for pioneering in that area. Probably not the easiest place in the world to start.
Well, thank you. Again, I worked in the world of commercial industrial performance contracting. So I wasn't in the world of just selling green. We were selling hard dollar savings, and we had to build to that level. And so I know if I can do it in North Dakota with the most extreme climate zone, We're at 9,400 heating rebates here, but the lowest electricity cost and the lowest natural gas cost. And none of those, is that going to change in the next 20 years? Because we have very efficient coal utilities that meet all EPA standards, been upgraded, and we have very almost giveaway natural gas. We can build and get those savings to have a payback under 20 years in our extreme market. So I know it can be done in other markets where the cost of energy is much higher and the climate is much more milder. But even with good solid engineering, it still takes getting those four major professional groups to somehow work together, because otherwise it isn't going to happen. The average builder does not have the marketing or engineering expertise to carry the ball themselves. There has to be some coordinated effort to make it happen. You know,
yeah,
I can make it happen because I have the background, but the average builder doesn't. The average realtor, no. The average banker, no. There needs to be some coordination.
Yeah, I agree with that. The economic incentives aren't enough. I'm in Manhattan right now. Con Ed power is, you know, 17 to 19 cents a kilowatt hour. The paybacks are there, and yet it's still very difficult to get uptake. And education, definitely a part of it across the disciplines. You're absolutely right about that. But I think also definitely a role for building codes, for business improvement districts, for other ways of getting that kind of collective action coordinated.
I would say one comment is when you're dealing with building inspectors, they're a group that a lot of times gets left out of this mix. They generally get very little energy building science training. And so the builder a lot of times will defer to the building inspector to get their opinion when there's code changes or green changes. And it just becomes a blank stare from the building inspector. They don't know how to respond to this. I joined the building officials in my market about 5 years ago, and I can stand up and talk to them and teach them, and they'll call me with questions that builders give them, and they feel they at least have a resource to help them out. But, you know, that's where it really takes a community to work together to make it happen. So you really can't leave the building inspectors guys out of the picture.
Do you have a kind of action
this
plan
is Baird. I guess the other, I mean, I come in some sense, I'm a lawyer, but I come out of the same world as you do in the sense that we're doing pooled energy efficiency at you know, institutional scale and trying to get financial benefits by financing large groups of projects rather than just single projects in addition to the rest. But my observation about the, as you go down from the world that Honeywell serves to the world that's getting served by the smaller guys, the quality of the contracts and the guarantees and the measurement and verification drop off sharply. And
yes,
getting, you know, a culture in which, you know, that that level of attention to the detail happens is I think critical.
Yes. Yeah, my experience, I've worked with seven different framing crews. A lot of the builders in my market don't have their own inside framing crew. And yet the framing crew is pretty critical to a high performance building, whether it's a multi unit building or a single family. And when they have all these questions day one and you can answer those questions out in the field and put it in simple terms for them, they just get really excited. They just, I mean, I'm going to be on this new rocket ship called a house and I'm part of the team, you know, and you start explaining it to them in simple terms. They just get excited and the builders, he said, you got everybody eating out of your hands. And I said, yeah, but it's nothing unique other than, yeah, I got the knowledge and experience, but you guys just can't answer their questions. So they'll stay building it the old way. But when somebody answers their question, puts it in economic or physics or building science terminology, they go, I never knew that. Cool. And they come up with you with, what if we do it this way? What do we do? I mean, they just, it's amazing how exciting they get. So, it's really critical. And I see the same thing with the building inspectors. They'll call me. I got that guy having this question. What should I tell them? We have to build those bridges with all of these different groups that it takes to build the building and get it financed, and then they get really excited. But right now the industry is so fractionalized, even at the building inspector court, there's nobody answering questions. And so, you know what happens with an unanswered question? Nothing moves forward. So.
So what's the next step here as far as moving forward on how to solve some of these problems, people involved, educated?
I mean, I feel like from a zoning and code policy, I mean, I think, looking at situations like Houston where, their zoning policies have arguably led directly to sort of making a bad situation worse, just in terms of what sort of impact those sorts of decisions can have on city and regional planning. And so, I mean, I hope that's an opportunity to at least start to have this conversation both around climate resilience in terms of, storm preparations and impervious surface versus green infrastructure, but also about energy and, building microgrids and building smart grids that you can isolate outages and leverage distributed energy resources, whether they're on a rooftop or at the sort of neighborhood scale.
How many of you are familiar with Passive House?
In Europe,
I'm a Passive House designer, and in Europe, they're making these buildings so efficient that distributive energy really is becoming passe, because there's just so little need for electricity and heating and cooling.
Yeah, you're familiar with the Passive House Institute in the United States, which has sort of split off from the German parent, but they're going in the same direction, although they're actually sort of collaborating with folks on DC microgrids.
Oh, they are, okay.
Yeah, we've seen some of that. We were shooting for the Passive House standard for some of our homes in terms of the air sealing, but we didn't go so far as the triple glazed windows and super, super tight doors. And we've been able to demonstrate net positive energy even without those.
What's your heating rebate market?
That's a good question. I don't know that off the top of my head.
Okay. Yes, the
southeastern Tennessee. We're sort of a balanced.
Okay, you're sort of a neutral. Yeah. Okay, I understand what you're saying there. I have some Passive House friends in Atlanta. So,
yeah, very similar to Atlanta.
Right. What's really popular in Europe right now is radiant ceiling heating and cooling systems.
Mm-hmm.
Where you just run PEX tubing into the ceiling with a radiant panel, and it does both your heating and cooling. So your install costs are low, your distribution costs are very low, and then they will just literally do a central air-cooled chiller plant that's a heat pump system that heats and cools. And it's extremely hot in Europe right now. It's very, very new in America. Some of those technologies I think are very ripe, and I actually, in my climate, we're starting in the next 2 weeks, two houses, one net zero, one 80% reduction house, and both of them will have radiant ceiling heating and cooling off of a heat.
What are you doing for dehumidification in that case?
Well, the first thing we do is we waterproof every piece of concrete. I mean, the footings, the foundation walls, everything. 95% of the moisture inside your houses, assuming your windows are mostly kept closed, is ground moisture. Well, we shut that off. And then we'll put smaller...
Not in the southeast.
Well, I understand in the southeast it's a different scenario than my market, but we will put in a small DX coil ahead of the air-to-air exchanger.
There you go.
We'll run it through a mixing valve off of our buffer tank to dehumidify the fresh air coming into the house.
Gotcha.
And you can do some ground.
Yeah.
And so, there's some simple ways to do it.
You just said a magic word. You've got a buffer tank when you're doing your cooling.
Yep.
And so you can chill the water whenever you want, and you can use it later.
Yes, and that way you reduce your stop-start cycles on your heat pump or chiller or whatever you...
But now you can also be selling services to the grid because you can time your use of electricity if you're not making it all yourself.
Right. The same thing with demand control for ice storage and things like that.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that. Yep. Yeah, that can be done, and when you're doing it in in my market, a four or sixplex would be the largest, multi-structure going up. You could put in a reasonable size buffer tank and be very efficient. Yeah.
Princeton University has a five-story tank. They chill water at night with 2 cent electricity It saves them $1 million a year on a $20 million energy bill.
Yeah, I've seen studies on that stuff. I'm also an energy manager from the Association of Energy Engineers out of Atlanta. I've seen a lot of articles on chilled trains, a big player in that market.
This is weird. I need to jump, but I'd love the opportunity to. Do we have people's phone numbers, Sierra?
Yes, everything is online at mscforum.com, and then go over to the left, find Connect, and then Meet the Leaders, and everybody's there.
Great. I'd love if people are willing to call a couple of folks up and chat a little further over the next week or so.
There's a couple of people that really should have been on this call, too, and they couldn't make it. Rob Hammond's one of them. Peter Ewers is another. So we'll try to get you all together again. Give me a topic to talk about, but there's an awful lot of really interesting things going on. So, cool. We'll go ahead and end it now unless you want to continue, everybody. We good for now?
I'm good.
Okay. I'm good.
All right. Super. Anyhow, we'll have another conference call next Thursday, and it's going to be on community solar. It should be very interesting, and a few of you I think I've asked to be on the panel for that. But we have some questions that some people want to know more about. How do you leverage the community solar for low-income areas and rural areas? And I think that should be a really interesting topic as well. And hopefully by then I'll have the passcode figured out so we won't have this problem. Sorry so much about that. It was a rough start to the conference call. So
thanks, Sierra, for putting it on.
Thanks, Sierra.
Yeah, thanks for you all for coming. It's good conversation.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
The host has joined the conference.